The deluge of movie awards shows has subsided briefly, with many of the critics groups and Hollywood industry guilds having donned their tuxedos and gowns and bestowed their blessings on a bevy of films and filmmakers. If you're an award show junkie, then this award season could be best summed up in a single word: consensus. I'm Charles Horak, and you're listening to On Film. The nation's largest group of critics, the Broadcast Film Critics Association, held its 19th annual Critics' Choice Movie Awards last week in Los Angeles, and my guests joined me at the star-studded awards show. Cynthia Haynes is a fellow voting member of the Broadcast Film Critics Association and joins us from her home in Lawrence, Kansas. Good morning, Cindy.
Good morning, Chuck.
Great to talk to you. We just spent an amazing day in L.A., surrounded by Hollywood A-list. I thought right off the bat we should run down a few of the major award winners from our Critics' Choice Movie Awards. Best Picture went to 12 Years a Slave, Matthew McConaughey, Dallas Buyers Club. Best Actor, Best Actress went to Cate Blanchett, Blue Jasmine. Best Supporting Actor, Jared Leto, Dallas Buyers Club as well. Good night for Dallas Buyers Club. Best Supporting Actress, Lupita Nyong'o for 12 Years a Slave. Best Acting Ensemble, a category we have that the Oscars don't have, went to American Hustle. I think the biggest surprise in the main categories for me was Alfonso Cuarón for Best Director, Gravity.
I think it was a real toss-up among all the directors. And again, it's so difficult to just single out one individual. But I think people realized how much it took in terms of new technology and skill in filmmaking to create that movie, Gravity. And
so it was a balancing act that they rewarded there.
Right. And if anyone has an opportunity to see that film in 3D, that is the best way to see it. It was meant to be shown on 3D. I wouldn't put it in the Avatar category, but it certainly it was a very effective way to get the sensation of being in outer space.
This was a year that the awards were fairly evenly distributed among four or five main contenders, and I think a really good year for films, at least the last month or two of the film year. We had a pretty wide range, and I think it was, for me at least going in, it was a toss-up between four or five films. I could make really strong arguments to go a number of different directions, which made it hard for us to vote.
Over 900 movies were released last year, and I'm singing the same tune I sang last year.
Yes,
and we've narrowed films worthy of attention down to 12. I mean, how can that be? I mean, so many films are left out, and it just goes back to this marketing campaign that the studios finance to get movies nominated. And for working professionals, they don't have time to sit down and watch all the, what did we get, over 100 screeners this past year?
I think I got 102.
Yeah, and we feel obligated as film critics. So I think, you know, our decisions are quite valid because we do see everything.
You make a great point every year, though, that becomes a broken record around our table. There's a bit of an absurdity in naming the best picture or the best director or the best actor. It's when you get into this kind of rarefied air, why can't we just celebrate all 10 or 12 or 15 or 20 films and their accomplishments?
Well, you've heard me say this before. I've been going to this for 10, 12 years now. And one of the first years I went, it was an afternoon event. Everyone knew in advance who won. So all the winners were there, but they were, for instance, the actors were introduced by their directors. And the directors were given a lot of time to talk about why they cast that actor, why that performance was particularly exceptional. Actors introduced directors and talked about their work, and it was a joyous, joyous occasion. And it wasn't a case of, and the award goes to, and then, you know, you sit there with egg on your face. It was just really a celebration. And I think one of the worst things about our show was the hostess. And she started out by saying, you know, that you're in a room full of people who hate movies and, you know, we're going to announce the ones we hate the least. And it was like, hello, it's just the opposite. I mean, we watch all these movies because we love them. So,
That's a good point. I think you and I, too, were talking before the show that one of the fascinating things, spending time in Hollywood each year, and I usually take a studio tour or two and go see folks at studios, is, you know, there has been a paradigm shift in the last decade in how films are made. And you look at our best picture list, which includes American Hustle, Captain Phillips, Dallas Buyers Club, Gravity, Her, Inside Llewyn Davis, Nebraska, Saving Mr. Banks, 12 Years a Slave, The Wolf of Wall Street. I think two of those films were directly financed by a Hollywood studio. The rest were the result of an individual or an outside production company getting behind one of these directors' visions and making that film happen.
In a sense, these are independent films. And every year people say, huh? They've never heard of these films because they've not shown in local theaters, or they were shown for 1 week to qualify for whatever. And that's another frustrating thing. But then again, we've brought attention to those films, and when they're on video on demand or available on Netflix or available to rent on DVD, people will bother to take the time to watch them. Wolf of Wall Street, Philomena, and 12 Years a Slave were all financed outside the studio system. Mm-hmm. And there's one woman who is changing the face of filmmaking in Hollywood. They're calling her the next Harvey Weinstein. Her name's Megan Ellison. She's a 28-year-old daughter of Larry Ellison of Oracle, and she's financed American Hustle and Her.
Yeah.
And then in the past, she financed The Master, Zero Dark Thirty, The Hurt Locker, Spring Breakers, The Grandmaster. So this young woman has taken the fortune that her father acquired and is using it to get those kinds of independent films that the main studios aren't interested in producing.
And she's 28.
28. She went to USC Film School for 1 year, so that should, you know, tell you something that it does.
Well, what's extraordinary, though, is that a director like David O. Russell or a writer-director also like Spike Jonze for Her, perhaps these films, certainly two of the finest films made this year, I think, would not exist had it not been for her production company and her getting those films. You look at something like 12 Years a Slave, an extraordinary document, an amazing film, you know, that languished for years, and then Brad Pitt's company got behind it, and of course he has a cameo in the film, but if it hadn't been for his producing credit and his production mm-hmm. company, one wonders if 12 Years a Slave would ever have been made. I know Red Granite did Wolf of Wall Street entirely with their own financing, and you met Oprah, who I think without Oprah, The Butler wouldn't have gotten made.
Well, that's true. She also is providing an opportunity for documentary filmmakers to show their work on her O channel.
Mm-hmm.
So she's very interested in lending her name, lending her money, and her clout to filmmakers who are producing things that she thinks are worthy. I happen to be standing next to Oprah when Lupita Nyong'o accepted her award as Best Actress, and Oprah had tears flowing down her cheeks, and I was moved too at the same time. We kind of looked at each other, and so the financing and support are coming from all different directions these days. And many women for years have gotten involved in the producing business, older actresses as they age,
mm-hmm.
because they're not getting opportunities and they're not getting the kind of scripts that they want. So it's a whole new ballgame, Chuck. I really believe it is.
You definitely think that the next 10 years is going to see a major upheaval in Hollywood of how things are getting made. And I think our notion of Hollywood as a geographic place that has an industry
right.
is already mostly gone, but it still lingers on in our imaginations as a driver of these things. I met Kevin Spacey, who, on top of being a great actor, has also really got the producer chops, and I think history is going to see, as one of the early enthusiastic pioneers of this paradigm shift away from television and cable. Of course, he produced and drove a lot of House of Cards being made for Netflix, which mm-hmm. when it came out was the first fully originally produced major production that went directly to streaming, skipped television, skipped cable, and it's an amazing show. So here we're sitting talking to people that I think in the next decade or two will be seen as, you know, these are pivotal moments where these individuals stepped up and changed the course of how narrative film and documentary film is made.
Well, this year at Sundance, Richard Linklater, who has a very interesting film coming out, where over the course of 12 years, he's followed a young boy as he's aged and has told this fictional story. I'm looking forward to seeing it. But he said at Sundance, you know, don't worry about distribution. Don't worry about getting picked up by Sony Picture Classics. He said, you know, go to video on demand right now, because there are opportunities. And the industry is trying to figure out how to deal with that. The theater owners are so distressed because they've invested fortunes in converting to digital technology.
Yes.
And now all this, you know, the same Friday it opens, you can, you know, watch it on your television. So they're suffering. They're hurting here, too. And you know, who knows where that'll go. But truly, the industry itself is very concerned about distribution and pirating and all these things that are happening now that 10 years ago weren't an issue.
So do you have some favorite encounters with directors or actors from the show?
You know, it's pretty cool to be in a room. I think you spoke with so many talented people. I think you spoke with Jason Schwartzman, who said everywhere he looked, he said he saw somebody famous, and he's getting famous himself. I'm sure he's quite recognizable on the street. He's a very good actor. I went up to Tom Hanks and introduced myself and said I was with the Broadcast Film Critics Association. He said, "Prove it." And I hesitated, and then he said, "Show me some ID." And then I realized he was joking, and he was very charming. But I think the most fun for me, Charles, was seeing your 15-year-old son, Richard, and my daughter, Alexa, having the opportunity to interact with actors and filmmakers that they admire, because they're both film buffs. So that was a whole lot of fun.
It was wonderful to sit back and watch that happen and then work the room. I think for me, talking with Martin Scorsese, who, you know, made a film this year, The Wolf of Wall Street, that you and I have disagreed passionately about. You didn't care for it, and I think it is an amazing achievement. But it's incredibly unsettling, outrageous, disturbing, profane. All those words are true. He certainly just about his most provocative film ever. But we had this marvelous conversation about censorship and the Hollywood Production Code, and of course, being a classic film buff and loving classic Hollywood, we couldn't not talk about Ernst Lubitsch and Preston Sturgis in the 40s, whose comedies were really pushing the boundaries of what was acceptable in the 40s, and then, of course, Otto Preminger in the 50s and 60s. So I do think that history will see this moment as an important moment, and that film as one that perhaps broke the current production code, if you will. It's the rating system. If that can be an R-rated film, then I'm not sure R ratings mean anything anymore.
Well, Chuck, they don't. And the thing is, that's an NC-17 movie if there ever was one.
Yeah.
And I don't understand why they don't use that rating. But as far as the film itself goes, I've never seen as X-rated a movie made for mainstream theaters as Wolf of Wall Street. And I also want to make the point that it's really incredible that Martin Scorsese cannot find financing for the kinds of movies he wants to make, that he has to go outside of the studio system to get funding. And that's a statement right there.
Well, I know it's always great to meet important filmmakers in person and work that room and be among them, but I also know that we share the best part of the award season is just getting to see so many great films. So I want to thank you for speaking with us today, and I hope you keep watching.
You bet.
I've been discussing last week's Critics' Choice Movie Awards and movie awards in general with Cynthia Farrah Haynes, fellow member of the Broadcast Film Critics Association and former host of this program. Haynes is a weekly film commentator on Lawrence, Kansas's public radio station KCUR, and you can hear her reviews and thoughts at kcur.org. An archive of past programs is available on this station's website at ktep.org. I'm Charles Horak. Thank you for listening to On Film.